Struggle of Empires. This is a game for 2 to 7 players, where each player represents one of 7 European powers in the 18th century, vying for control or vying for power. First, a brief overview, and then we'll get into the details of the game rules. This is in many ways an area control game or a war game. Unlike other war games, though, you're not really ever attacking other players' home countries. You're really just vying for control, area control, of several regions on the map. The game plays out in 3 phases, or wars, in the terms of the game, that represent 3 periods in history during which there were almost continuous battles, apparently, in Europe. Power is represented by victory points, so this game is all about collecting victory points over the course of 3 wars, each of which are broken down into several rounds. Okay, so that's an overview of the game. Now let's go ahead and get into the nitty-gritty. First, a look at the components. The map is very colorful and actually very nice looking. There are several regions, North and South America, Caribbean, Africa, India, and East Indies, which are shown along the outer portion of the map, and these are all colonies. And then the main portion of the board consists of Europe. There are 4 scoring areas in Europe: German states, Mediterranean, Ottoman Empire, and the Central Europe areas. And all the scoring areas on the board have numbers, victory points, written underneath the name. The rest of Europe depicts the players' home countries. The home countries have a very small role in this game. They're really only useful for determining legal movements and unit placements. And I'll go over those things in detail later. The board also depicts a victory point track around the edges, a track to record the phases of the game, the wars, also areas to record each player's population, and then alliances, which are really one of the main components of this game. In addition to the board, there are a whole lot of chits. Each player has a set of chits in their own color. The round ones represent control tokens. The square chits are either fortresses, boats, or infantry. In addition, there are also unrest tokens, which are the gray tokens with numbers on them. There are also a collection of country tokens, or region tokens, which have a name of one of the scoring regions on the board, and then either population or slaves, or some number. These are used to set up the game and to randomize components of the game each phase or each war. They also include some dice, which are used for combat and for movement, and 5 small black wooden discs, which I assume are used to keep track of the rounds and the wars, although you only really need 2 discs for that. I haven't quite figured out what the other 3 are for. Finally, there are about 37 tiles, which are divided into 3 groups. Alliance tiles have a small A on the bottom right. Improvement tiles are white. And then there are company tiles, which are colored, associated with a different areas on the board, and colored according to the area that they're associated with. And finally, there are also tokens representing gold. The small copper-colored tokens represent 1s, and the silver-colored tokens represent 5 gold. Okay, to set up the game, you randomly draw 10 of those country counter tokens
and put them in the corresponding areas of the map face-up.
You put one of those wooden cylinders on the round 1 mark. Another cylinder goes on the war 1 mark on the board. Randomly determine a starting player, and each player picks a color or randomly chooses a European power. Then each player puts one of their control tokens on the 0 victory point position on the victory track. They place another control marker on the 5 space of the population track. They draw 5 additional country counters randomly and place 1 marker on each of the areas depicted by each of those country tokens. And finally, each player gets 10 gold. Note that these last 5 tokens that each player drew and used to place their control tokens on the board are removed from the game. Finally, starting with the starting player and then rotating clockwise, each player will place one of their military units, one at a time, into any area on the board. They'll continue to do this until everyone has placed 5 units. Armies and forts that are placed can be placed in any of the 11 scoring areas on the map. Navies can go in any of the 8 areas that have water in them. That is, any of those 11 areas except for the German states, Central Europe, or the Ottoman Empire. After that setup, we were able to begin the game proper. The game will start in the First War. There will be 3 wars. Each war consists of either 5 or 6 rounds, depending on how many players are playing. With 2, 3, or 4 players, there are 6 rounds per war. With 5, 6, or 7 players, there are 5 rounds per war. The first thing that happens in each war is that players will be bidding on not only play order, but also alliances. The starting player makes a bid, and the minimum bid can be 0. And he proposes 2 countries. One country will be in Alliance A, and the other will be in Alliance B. The bid passes clockwise, and players may either raise the bid and change the proposed countries if they choose, or pass. Bidding continues round and round until every player but one has passed. When that occurs, those 2 countries are fixed in the Alliance A and Alliance B that was proposed. Then, the next player, clockwise from the starting player, starts the next auction. They make the next proposal, choosing 2 different countries, one for Alliance A and one for Alliance B, and again, bidding goes round and round. This process continues until all countries have been divided and are either part of Alliance A or Alliance B. In a game with an odd number of players, that last auction will only be for position of the last country, whether it will be in Alliance A or Alliance B. Note that in addition to determining alliances, players are also bidding on play order. The first 2 countries to have been auctioned are first and second place, then third and fourth place for the next pair, etc., all the way to seventh place. There's a place on the board to help keep track of these things. To the left of the board, under the proposal section, there's a gray box labeled A and a white box labeled B, which players use as they're making their proposals. Once a proposal has been accepted, the country control tokens are moved to the alliance area below, which shows 4 spots for Alliance A and 4 spots for Alliance B, again color-coded gray and white. The board spaces also denote play order. After alliances are chosen, players take their actions. And this is the meat of the game. This is where you'll spend most of your time. Each round, each player in turn takes up to 2 actions. And they have several choices for what those actions can be. They can always pass, although that's rarely going to be advisable in a game with such tight resources. Players may build a unit and move that unit. They may move 2 units. They may make an attack. They may buy a tile, or they may colonize or enslave. Those last 2 options, buying a tile and colonizing or enslaving, may only be done by each player once per round. So they could only use 1 of their actions for each of those options. Now in detail. Building a unit is simple. It simply costs 1 population. The player moves their token down 1 space in the population track that's on the board. If they're already at 0, obviously they cannot build any military units. The unit is placed in that player's home country, and from there they may move it following the movement rules. Now, movement in this game is a little strange, at least in comparison to other war games. You do not move necessarily from one country to an adjacent country, or from along any particular route. You simply pick up your tokens that are moving from their source country and then drop them in a legal destination country or destination region. The map is useful here to figure out what is a legal destination. Movement within Europe is pretty simple. A player may move an army to any European area where they already have a control token, or that is adjacent to another area where they have a control token, or that is adjacent to that player's home country, or if they have a naval unit in a water area that's adjacent to the region they'd like to move in. So, what's adjacency? Well, you could almost tell from the map, although really the map isn't quite as clear as it could be. There are two water areas in Europe, the Baltic area and the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean area includes Italy, the scoring region, and the Baltic area includes the Baltic scoring region. Spain is considered to border and be adjacent to the Mediterranean. It is not adjacent to any other region in Europe. France also is adjacent to the Mediterranean. In addition, it is adjacent to the German states. Britain consists not only of the island, but the Atlantic Ocean surrounding that space. That water area around England is not a legal place to position naval units. Britain, then, is considered to border the German states and also the Baltic area. The United Provinces also border the German states and the Baltic area. Prussia is adjacent to the Baltic area and Central Europe. Russia, with its wide borders, is adjacent to the Baltic, Central Europe, and the Ottoman Empire. And finally, Austria. Austria is adjacent to German states, Central Europe, the Ottoman Empire, and the Mediterranean. For movement purposes, the Ottoman Empire is adjacent to the Mediterranean Ocean. So, a player with a navy in the Mediterranean is free to place their military units, their army units, in the Mediterranean, and also the Ottoman Empire. A player with a navy in the Baltic can place their army in the Baltic as well. Placement of armies, or movement of armies to the colonies, requires the presence of a boat in the appropriate colonial region. Now, if movement to a colony results in that military unit crossing a rope border that's depicted on the board, for example, there's a rope border between Europe and the New World, if a unit crosses a rope barrier, they must make a travel hazard check. Basically, they roll dice to see what the outcome of the movement attempt is. They roll 1d6. If they roll a 1, they roll another d6. On the second six-sided die, on a roll of 1 or 2, that unit is lost. It is taken to the discard pile. On a roll of 3 or 4, the movement fails and the unit returns to its origin region. And on a roll of 5 or 6, the movement succeeds. Movement and of naval units follow these same rules. So if a player is building a naval unit, it is placed in their country, and then it is moved to its destination region. If that move requires crossing of a rope barrier, then they are required to make a travel check, or a sea check. It's also important to note that this is the only time that forts may move. If a player is building a fort, again, it is placed in their home country, and then it moves to its destination. Once it successfully reaches a destination, it is there for the rest of the game, or until it is destroyed and returned to that player's stock. A player may choose to destroy their own fort later on to build it in a different location, but they will still pay a penalty for losing that unit, which I'll talk about in the combat section. Okay, so that was the build a single unit and move that unit action. The next action I'll talk about is the Move 2 Units action. In this case, the player moves up to 2 units, one at a time, following the same rules we just went over. Just a reminder here that the C check is required only when you cross the rope barrier. So, for example, moving between North America and the Caribbean and South America does not require a C check. It simply requires the presence of a naval unit in the destination region. Okay, the next action to talk about then is the attack action. To make an attack, a player must pay 2 gold, and they declare the area that they're attacking. They may attack another player's control tokens or another player's military units, or they may attack a neutral control token. Neutral control tokens are those tokens that we set the board up with that have a country name on them and a number. That number is considered to be the strength of that control token. If the attacked area has a C region, which would be every area except the German states and Central Europe, then you need to determine which player, if any, will receive naval support. If the attacker has naval units in that area, he decides whether he wants to make a naval attack. If the attacker foregoes the naval combat, then the defender will win naval support. If the attacker decides to fight, then the defender must choose whether they would like to fight naval combat or cede the naval support to the attacker. If they decide not to fight, then their naval unit is safe. If both players have decided to fight, their strengths are determined as follows. Each player gets 1 point of strength for every naval unit in the combat. In addition, they may ask their allies for help. These allies include the alliance tiles, which we'll talk about later, and also the other players who are on their alliance. Other players in their alliance decide whether or not they will contribute any ships to the fight, and if so, how many ships they will contribute. Alliance tiles provide another point of strength, 1 point for each tile in that region. Whichever side has the greater number of Navy training tiles gets another +1. Each player then rolls 2d6 and calculates the difference between those two numbers and adds that difference to the other totals, the totals of the numbers of naval units and alliance naval units and alliance tiles. And that is their strength in this fight. The highest total wins, with the loser losing 1 naval unit. In a tie, both players lose a unit, and neither one gets naval support. In addition, any player who rolls a 7 on their 2d6 loses an extra naval unit. If a player's allies had contributed any ships in combat, then they are the ones who would lose this second unit. Every lost unit gains that player 1 unrest token, or 1 unrest point. Unrest is a bad thing, which we'll talk about later. Whoever wins combat gains naval support, which means that they will get to add +1 to the land combat in that region, which occurs next. One caveat, when you are calling for help from your allies, other player allies can contribute ships. They cannot contribute the help that they get from their special powers based on any of their tiles. So no alliance tiles, no combat bonuses from tiles, etc. So, after the naval combat has been resolved, if there was one, you move on to the land combat, and this occurs the same way. The attacker must have 1 army, at least, to fight. They get 1 point of strength for each army that's in the fight. They also get 1 point for each army that their allies contribute. Defenders get plus 2 for each fort in the region, only defenders. The side with more army training tiles gets an additional plus 1, and again, alliance tiles may give you a plus 1. Again, you roll 2d6 and add the difference between your 2d6 to all the other modifiers. Again, the highest total wins. The loser loses one of their units. In the case of a tie, both players lose a unit, although you never lose a fort simply due to a tie in combat. However, the defender does retain control of that region. If the attacker wins, then they replace the defender's control token in that region with one of their own. And as before, if a player rolls a 7, then they lose an extra unit. If that resulted in the loss of 2 units, and any allies had contributed units to the fight, then the ally is the one who would lose the extra army unit. Every unit lost results in the gain of 1 unrest. The loss of a control token does not result in any unrest. There's no penalty for losing the control token. If the defender did not have a control token there, then the attacker does not get to place one of their own. You only put your control token down if you are attacking a control token of an enemy nation. It is helpful to keep in mind that the odds are not great if you are attacking with a advantage of less than plus 2. That is, if the attacker's strength is only two higher than the defender's strength, your chances of winning are only about 77%. Even then, you have about a 1 in 3 chance of losing 1 or 2 units. In order to improve the chances of winning up to 89%, you need to have an attacking strength that is 3 greater than the defender's strength. If this attack had been on a neutral country tile, where the number on the tile represented their strength, and the attacker wins, then they get to place their control token in that region, and that country tile is removed from the game. Again, that number on the tile represents that country's token's defensive strength, and another player would roll a pair of d6 for that combat. The difference would be added to that token's defensive strength. Country tokens never lose units. They are simply there until a player defeats them and places that player control token in that region. Okay, so that's the attack action choice. The colonize or enslave choice is much simpler. Some of the country tokens have the word POP on them, short for population. The colonize or enslave action is simply to replace that token with a player's control marker at the cost of one population. They simply move their population marker down one space on the population track. Other neutral country tokens have slaves written on the little chit. It requires an enslavement action, which is the same as a colonization action, to replace those chits with a player's control token. In order to do so, they must have a naval unit in Africa. That's it. That's all that's required. If you have a boat in Africa, you can simply discard the slave country token and replace it with your own control token. Again, this action, the colonize or enslavement action, can only be done once per round, one of the two actions. And finally, we have the buy one tile action. This is very simple. Once per round, a player may choose to use their action to buy a tile. The cost is depicted on the tile. It may be free, it may cost some combination of gold, unrest, and or population. Most of these tiles are yours for the rest of the game. Some tiles have a specific action that is used, and then the tile is discarded. Other tiles are used and then returned to the supply and become available for other players. The alliance tiles are yours through the entire war, and then are returned to the supply so that they're again available for everybody for the next war. I'm not going to go through what every tile does in detail. I'd simply be reading off a list. The tiles are really what add complexity to this game. The rules are pretty straightforward, but there is a large variety of options that the tiles give you. Some tiles modify your basic actions. For example, logistics allows you to move an extra unit when you choose the move two units action. Other tiles give you a brand new ability. The thing to keep in mind with the tiles is that any use of the tile actions does not count as one of your two actions. So it can be very helpful to get the appropriate tiles depending on what your strategy in the game is going to be. So to recap, the choices for your two actions each round are to build a unit, move that unit, move two units, make an attack, colonize or enslave, buy a tile, or pass. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned so far is how the income works in this game. After all players have conducted all actions for 5 or 6 rounds, you move on to the income and maintenance phase. Players earn 1 gold per population they have. They also earn 1 gold per control token they have on the board. They must, however, pay 1 gold in maintenance fees for every military unit on the board. At any time in the game at all, if a player needs more gold, they may simply take it from the bank at a rate of 2 gold per 1 unrest. That is, if they want 2 gold, they must also take 1 unrest. That unrest is theirs for the rest of the game, with the exception of some of the tiles that allow you to discard unrest. So players may take gold whenever they need it, during an auction, during the income and maintenance phase where they're paying for their units, etc. After players have earned gold and paid maintenance, each player gains 5 in population, up to a maximum of 9 as shown on the population track on the board. Finally, players earn victory points. Looking at each region in turn, the player with the most control tokens in that region gets the highest number of victory points that's shown on the board. Second highest number of control tokens gets the next number, and finally, if there's a third number, then the player with the third most number of control tokens earns that many victory points. In cases of ties, all players earn the same number of points. So if two players are tied for first place, they both earn the value of points shown on the board. And that marks the end of the war. At the end of the war, tokens are reset, alliance tiles returned to the supply area, markers are moved to indicate that the next war is starting, the round marker goes to round 1, and you do it all over again. This happens for 3 wars, where you're scoring victory points at the end of each war. Before the start of the second and third wars, the board is again seeded with 10 randomly chosen country tokens. At the end of the game, we conduct one last scoring. This is when everyone reveals their unrest tokens, which they had been keeping secret up until this time. Any player with more than 20 unrest automatically loses the game, and their score is reduced to 0. After that, any of the remaining players compare their unrest. Whoever has the highest total of unrest loses 7 victory points, and whoever has the second highest total loses 4 victory points. Again, all tied players suffer the same penalty. At the end of it all, whoever has the highest total victory points wins the game. So, there are 2 ways to earn victory points: by gaining control of regions and by buying the industry tile. There are 2 ways to gain unrest: by taking gold from the bank in multiples of 2, and by losing units in combat. Too much unrest can cost you victory points or even the game. The only way to get rid of unrest is to buy the government reform time. This is a tight, tight game with limited resources and limited options. I am really looking forward to trying to play it again. I would expect the first game, at least, to take many hours, many, many hours, especially if you have many players. But I think the game may well be worth the effort. And there you have it, the first audio rules summary, although it's a little long for a summary. I think it was fairly clear. We'll see how it goes, and maybe I will do this again, maybe not, we'll see. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks.